Dodgers tycoon Richard Branson is dangling a $25 million prize before the world, asking anybody to come up with a way to reduce greenhouse gases. As ABC7's Eric Rosales reports, at least one Bay Area company believes it's only a matter of time before the world realizes it has the answer.
One Bay Area company believes they've already mastered the $25 million technology and science prize, Planktos Incorporated.
My phone started ringing at 6 o'clock this morning, and the email filled up and messages said, "Go for it, Russ."
There isn't a scientific group in the world that we've discovered that actually thinks this is a good idea.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and we'll spend the next hour talking with one of the most controversial climate entrepreneurs in the world today. Russell George is the CEO and visionary of Planktos Corporation. He says we need to save the ocean life and the carbon-soaked atmosphere by seeding plankton blooms. This fall, he says, the company's research ship, the Weatherbird 2, will sail off to the far Pacific past the Galapagos Islands to dump 100 tons of iron into the sea. They will measure what happens to the explosion of plankton. Will enough carbon dioxide sink to the bottom of the sea to slow down climate change? It's a huge experiment in our oceans. Environment groups from the World Wildlife Fund to Greenpeace have condemned Planktos. The Pope has blessed the company and accepted carbon offsets from them. Government bodies are slowly churning to stop the voyage, while penny stock promoters are predicting hundreds of millions of dollars in profits for Planktos. The issues Russell George raises are so profound. Radio EcoShock will take the next two shows just to cover it all. How serious is the decline of ocean life? Can plankton blooms help save a civilization addicted to fossil fuels? According to a presentation for the Carnegie Council recently by Dr. Michael Oppenheimer, plankton may have tipped Earth's entire climate in times past. Just listen to this little clip.
One theory, for instance, is that when Earth's orbit is in a particular inclination, that the amount of sunlight reaching the southern hemisphere in their summer, the southern summer, increases the pattern. And we know this. This does happen. The theory then is that, for instance, increases the production of algae at the ocean surface. There's a particularly rich area with a lot of nutrients where algae get produced. And that algae production, of course, it's photosynthesis. It sucks carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. When the algae dies, it sinks to the bottom of the ocean. That means there's less carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, a lower greenhouse effect, and Earth starts cooling. Earth starts cooling, ice sheets start expanding.
So we are dealing with huge planetary mechanisms here. Some scientists believe that plankton even helps create the clouds that bring rain to the land. But do we know what we're doing? Should a private bootstrap corporation be allowed to sell carbon credits before the science is solid? Is Russell George showing us the way or making a quick profit on our worries about climate change? The first step is to ask him. Russell George has given an exclusive interview to Radio EcoShock. We give him the platform to explain his vision, his company, and the science. Later in the interview, I ask some of the tough questions posed by his critics, and George has answers for most of them. As you know, governments are not only failing to deal with climate change, they continue to subsidize the fossil fuel industries and infrastructure that make it worse. Is it time for a radical business pioneer? Do carbon offsets work? You must decide. We'll hear out Russell George this week, and then interview some of his critics next week, the environmentalists, the stock watchers, the scientists. Get ready for some tough radio on the future of your ocean, your climate, and your planet. Planktos, raising the dead seas this week and next on Radio EcoShock. As the climate crisis threatens to spin out of control, new entrepreneurs are working to find ways to remove the principal greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, out of the air. And one of these is Russell George, the CEO of Planktos Corporation. We have him with us today from his head office in Foster City, California. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi there.
Hi. Well, Russ, can you give us a little bit of your background, how you got interested in environmental solutions?
Well, I'm an environmental science guy by background, and I went to school in classical plant ecology, largely, and shortly after university, I ended up in living in British Columbia, actually, and started working as a tree planter there back in the very early 70s, and started a tree planting company called Coast Range, and that company went on to plant hundreds of millions of trees across Canada, although it was sold by the partner, myself and the original partners, in the mid-90s. I think it's still going today.
Yeah.
Subsequent to that, I've been working on environmental management projects for both government and industry, both in Canada and the U.S. and around the world.
Well, do you have training directly in the oceans field?
My university training wasn't in ocean science, but I was I've always been a sailor. I bought my first sailboat in Cole Harbor down in Vancouver back in the 70s, and I was a hardcore ocean sailor for many years, and I've been involved in a lot of ocean fisheries projects with Canadian agencies for many years. So typical of a Canadian government environmentalist, you often have to wear many hats, and one of the hats I had to wear a lot of times in Canada was an ocean science hat.
And did you work for Greenpeace at one point?
I did. At one point in time, I was hired by Greenpeace to try to convince the ship operations people to convert the Rainbow Warrior into a ocean research vessel. And part of my assignment in order to do that was I had to go out on a mission with the Rainbow Warrior and join the crew and learn how everything worked. So I've spent my time at night watch at the helm of the old Rainbow Warrior just before the French blew her up and sank her.
Really? Well, I realize that your company name, Planktos, refers to your plans to use plankton to grab CO2 out of the air, but I'd like to start with another company project, the planting trees in Hungary. Can you tell us about that?
Well, our Hungarian project that we created is called Klimafa, which means climate tree in Hungarian, and as a matter of fact, I have another business that I'm working on and with the Haida Indians in Queen Charlotte Islands called the Haida Climate Project. And both of those projects are about growing trees, new forests, for the purpose of sucking carbon dioxide out of the air that trees are happy to do and storing that carbon dioxide in those living ecosystems. And in doing so, you earn what's called a carbon credit in the world community these days.
I'm sorry, and that can become a business then, selling the carbon credits?
Sure. Carbon credits are part of the mechanism that the Kyoto Accord set up, and many other jurisdictions that aren't part of the Kyoto Accord, many of the U.S. states and municipalities are doing this. It's a market-based mechanism to provide an economic motivation for the world to basically invent solutions to the climate change issue, to the problem of fossil CO2. And so that we can develop technologies that will effectively remove CO2 from the air or prevent it from going into the air. And forests and ocean plants, what we call the plankton, the ocean forest, are the only ways that you can really effectively remove CO2 from the atmosphere once it's there. You know, they work with free solar energy, and they very efficiently scrub CO2 out of the atmosphere and park it in that living ecosystem.
Well, your tree planting project got a lot of good publicity lately when the Catholic Church announced it would use Klimafa to offset the carbon emissions of the Vatican. That's kind of a turnaround, isn't it? Usually it's the Church who forgives other people's sins.
Well, that's right. And, you know, we had some friends who had who knew some people, some officials in the Vatican, and knew that they were interested in green actions. And, in fact, they've taken a number of green actions over the past number of years, and so we presented our case to the Vatican that it might become the first carbon-neutral sovereign state on Earth. It's the smallest sovereign state on Earth, but it's today the greenest one. And they chose to do that through our forest projects that we're planting in Europe, and those forest projects will begin this fall. We've already got seedlings in the nurseries in Hungary, and in this fall we'll begin planting those trees in the first 10,000 hectare project in the national park system in Hungary. And of course, planting trees in a national park is a good way to guard those trees. So if you're growing a tree for its value at storing carbon dioxide safely away from the atmosphere, you don't want someone to come in and cut it down or burn it as firewood. And so the best and safest place in the world to park a tree is inside of a European national park. So that's what we're doing.
Well, and you have an agreement with someone in Hungary to do this. Are they part of the program, the government there?
Yeah, we established a company, a subsidiary company in Budapest called Klimafa. And we have some Hungarian participants in that project. We have agreements with the Hungarian government. We have contracts with the Hungarian Academy of Sciences to do the technical forest modeling work on the project so that we can accurately predict how much carbon dioxide is being absorbed by our forests. And we have the very famous Sopron School of Forestry from the Western Hungarian University working with us on prescribing the proper forest planting methods, the tree species, and, you know, where to plant and what the mixture should be and the patterns of trees. And, of course, we have our own professional forestry staff, and we'll be hiring hundreds of workers to go into the fields of Hungary to restore some of, you know, Hungary used to be 70% forest, and today it's 17% forest. So the government there is eager to restore some of its forests and to do so in this very environmentally sensitive way where we're growing a native, restoring a native forest, not for timber this time, but for the benefit of the environment alone.
That does seem some revolutionary. Most planting, as you say, is done by forest companies, and they plan to cut it down again.
Right, and we all use forest products, so you have to engage in some of that. But for our purpose, we found that the value of a carbon credit, 1 ton of carbon dioxide taken from the atmosphere, and repositioned inside of a living ecosystem, that there's sufficient value in that that we can now apply pure environmental rationale to this work so that we don't need to seek any other additional values, commercial lumber values or things of that nature. We can simply plant the forest for the benefit of the environment. And, of course, there's many benefits. You know, it's not only is there carbon taken out of the atmosphere, there's a forest protect the waterways. They make sure that water runs clear and with less flooding, it provides habitat so that you enhance biodiversity. And there's just a plethora of environmental benefits from a forest.
How many years does it take before the young trees begin to absorb significant amounts of carbon dioxide?
Well, they begin absorbing carbon dioxide immediately. And the carbon marketplace that defines what a carbon credit of 1 ton of greenhouse gas emission offset credit, how that is defined, is quite variable. For instance, many wind projects these days, they generate carbon credits because a windmill offsets the use of fossil fuel. So the amount of energy that the windmill produces is equal to so many barrels or cubic meters of natural gas, and that has a carbon dioxide equivalent. But people who build windmills typically account for all of the carbon credit value of the windmill for the life of the windmill when they first build it. And they bring some of that value forward. And just the same as a wheat farmer who needs to invest in new equipment on his farm might sell the futures of his wheat production forward for quite a number of years in order to finance the project. So we're able to manage carbon offsets, as a commodity. They're a bankable, tradable commodity that has both a spot market price for today and a futures price. And they're a sophisticated financial instrument that we can manage in exactly the same way that we manage all other commodities in the marketplace.
And this tree planting solution as a way of sequestering carbon has received quite a boost lately, with a new publication in the journal Science. And according to this study, Dr. Renton Rigolato suggests that reforestation is a much better way forward than, say, biofuels. Have you been following that?
Well, we have been following it, and we think that growing green plants is definitely the greener solution to the crisis of fossil fuel, because when CO2 is in the atmosphere, the problem that really results is a problem to the living planet. Really, the first The first parts of the planet to suffer are those plant ecosystems. And they're scalded by the CO2 in the atmosphere that makes global warming, and they're scalded by the acidification of CO2 in the ocean. And what better thing to do than to use those very injured parties, those plants, to take that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and heal those ecosystems, those living green ecosystems, and have that carbon dioxide no longer be in the atmosphere where it's causing further harm, but at the same time, it's actually regrowing and restoring the harm that's been done. So it's really the greener solution.
I agree. Well, now, the famous scientist James Lovelock, and he's backed by the IPCC, is predicting that Europe will be so hot by 2040 that vegetation may change from forest to grasslands or even desert-like scrub. So let me play you that clip from his recent speech in Adelaide.
Now, I know more about Europe than Australia, and I think it's intriguing to me to know that if we take the average of the IPCC report, which is way below what the observations are suggesting, it tells us that by 2040, just 33 years from now, Europe will look very like Australia. You may remember there was a very hot summer in 2003 in Europe when between 20 and 30,000 people died of heat. In that summer, there was almost total drought and temperatures somewhere between 40 and 50 Celsius persisting throughout June, July, and August. That will be the norm, says the IPCC, by 2040. It sounds very much to me like an Australian climate. Now, people will probably manage if they've enough energy. They'll have air conditioning and desalinated water and so on. But growing crops will no longer be going on. There's no possibility whatever of Europe by then irrigating the whole of its continent. I'm not exaggerating here. As I say, this is somewhat in the middle of the IPCC forecast, not some extreme outlier. And already, in a way, the Sahara Desert is moving up into Europe. Southern Spain, southern Italy, and Greece are all becoming desert regions, too hot for crops to grow, too hot even for the ubiquitous olive of southern Europe to grow. So we have a pretty bad future in front of us.
We may not have to wait until 2040. Already there were terrible forest fires, as you know, in Portugal and Greece this year, and this summer of 2007 broke heat records all over Eastern Europe, including Hungary. Now, given the stability, or the instability of the climate, I should say, Russ, when people or institutions buy carbon offsets from your company, can they really count on this forest staying there?
Well, they can insofar as they manage a lot of different risks on their purchases of different commodities, and climate change commodities are one of those instruments that they have to risk manage. So, for instance, in the carbon market today in Europe, the price of a carbon credit from a sort of instantaneous source like an engineering source, you know, capturing methane that's leaking out of a coal mine or something of that nature, is about 20 euros per ton is the trading price. And a forest credit sells for about 70% of that price, so, you know, down around 14 euros per ton. And the reason why it sells for 30% less is that that 30% captures the value of the risk elements in that forest. So in that, this market's a very sophisticated market, and the buyers are very sophisticated buyers. We can very easily manage the risks, the various risks of, anything other than the cataclysmic ones like what Lovelock predicts, which, if Europe becomes the outback desert, you know, of Australia, the last thing I think we'll be worried about is whether the carbon credits we bought 30 years previous were the right price or not.
It's true. People may have to move north into Scandinavia or Russia if that happens. Well, I'd like to ask you just a little bit more about the Haida Climate Project. It is closer to home. The Haida Gwaii is a series of very large coastal islands on the northern BC coast. What can you tell us about this project?
Well, the Haida First Nations people came to me quite a number of years ago when I was working to develop some carbon climate forest projects in British Columbia in the temperate rainforest. And they asked me if I would help them set up that kind of ecoforestry, green-collar industry on their islands, the Haida Gwaii, because they have chronically high unemployment now that the woods industry is in great decline and the fishing industry has, had on the islands there is really no commercial fishing industry left. There's only the sport fishing industry. And so they were desperate for some way to take over their stewardship of those islands, and there's a lot of restoration that needs to be done there. And so we've designed a project that will be able to take advantage of the fantastic growth conditions of the British Columbia temperate rainforest. You know, the temperate rainforest of BC grows at about four times the biomass of the tropical rainforest, like the Amazon. So few people realize that the greatest rainforests on Earth are the temperate rainforests, not the tropical rainforests. So there's a great project there that we've been slowly plugging away at. In fact, I spent part of the morning on the telephone with some of the Haida people this morning, setting up project tours with some government officials to show them the projects that we're planning, and so that can get underway.
Does it need government approval?
Yes, unfortunately, all these projects, or fortunately, these projects need government approval because Canada is part of the Kyoto Protocol, so it's slowly adopting its measures. It was moving a lot faster before the change of government, and unfortunately, things have slowed down, but there is progress forward to produce this carbon marketplace in Canada, the cap and trade marketplace, to be able to develop carbon projects that sell offsets to the industries that need them and the individuals that choose to buy them. The forestry projects are, especially the really gem-like projects like the temperate rainforest projects in D.C. are quite spectacularly beautiful projects in terms of producing an effect.
Yes, we'll get a new improved ecosphere out of it. We are talking with Russell George, the CEO of a company with Newsworthy Ventures to remove CO2 from the atmosphere to help alleviate climate change. Let's move on to your more controversial plans to capture CO2 in the oceans by feeding algae by your company, Planktos. Listeners will get a chance to hear clips from your impassioned speech at the Chicago Green Festival last spring, but can you give us a short description of the Planktos project?
Well, the Planktos project is all about taking iron micronutrients, the mineral micronutrient iron that ordinarily comes from dust in the wind, and that dust feeds the distant oceans, you know, dirt from the land. If you look at dirt anywhere on the planet and it looks red, it's 3% iron, iron oxides, typically hematite iron ore. And if it looks tan colored, it's 1% iron. Well, the dust from the land is just like the rain from the ocean in terms of the planetary ecosystem. When rain from the land from the ocean rises up into the atmosphere and ends up falling on the dry lands of the world and deserts of the world, those land ecosystems bloom. And in the same fashion, when dust from the land rises up into the atmosphere and ends up under the ocean, and remember, this planet ocean of ours is 70% ocean. And so when that dust lands on the ocean plants are waiting for that mineral dust to bloom, and they do. So our project is following in the footsteps of 20 years and over $100 million worth of institutional research from governments around the world. And we're right at the stage where that institutional research has said this really does work, but it needs to be tested commercial scale. So we've set up a series of six commercial scale pilot projects. They're more or less identical to a stage three clinical trial for a new drug. The drug happens to have one patient only. It's poor old Mother Earth. But we're sure it's a blockbuster drug that will heal her ills and restore her trees and seas, and that's what Planktos is going to do. It's going to take dust that was formally blowing in the wind. We're going to take it back to the ocean. It's iron-rich dust, and we're going to try to restore and replenish the missing ocean plankton blooms.
And as we've heard or found out, that the algae is greatly reduced from what it used to be, according to the satellite measurements, even in the 1980s. Is that the case?
Yeah, the ocean plants have been declining at the same rate as the terrestrial rainforest. That's about 1% per year. And what that means in real numbers is that the North Atlantic Ocean has lost 17% of its plant life in the last 30 years, since we got the good satellites up in the early 80s to study these global systems. The North Pacific has lost 26% of its plant life. And in a major paper in the journal Science, I think it was this spring, there was a report that as much as 50% or more of plant life in the subtropical tropical oceans has disappeared. And that's a stunning collapse of the ocean plant ecosystem.
Well,
you know, in fact, there was another story. I'll give you another anecdotal note. There was a paper that came out a few weeks ago in one of the journals of science, and it talked about the discovery. If you Google it on the Internet under the clearest water on Earth, you'll discover a story about a ocean research team that found that in the tropical eastern Pacific, south of the Galapagos Islands, east of the French Polynesia, they found that water was so clear that UV light from the sunlight was penetrating more than 100 meters into the ocean. And they noted that the only other place on Earth water was so clear was in the Antarctic lakes that are buried beneath the, you know, mile or more of the Antarctic ice sheet, where they've been in the cold and dark for a half a million years and are as close to lifeless as any place on Earth. But where they found that the most lifeless water on Earth was in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, in a vast area. And, of course, those geophysicists reported it as a great physical curiosity about the ocean characteristics of the ocean, and those of us who are ocean ecologists sort of, you know, let out a breath of gasp, saying, oh, my God, that's lifeless ocean at a vast scale. So the oceans are in dire shape.
I have a clip about that that I'm going to play for the listeners. Again, Dr. James Lovelock, who has his own scheme for using algae to save the Earth, and I'll just play that now.
And the best system to work on is the ocean, and for two reasons. One, it's the biggest system on Earth. It's 70% of the surface. And secondly, there's nobody lives there, so you're not going to have any politics involved. And what you could do is, the reason the ocean's gone sour for us at the moment is that once the water gets over 14 Celsius, which is not very high, it forms a stable floating layer on top into which nutrients from below can't circulate. And as a consequence, the algae die or almost die, and you could look at the ocean as a desert. And you can see this yourselves. If you go anywhere in the tropical waters, it's beautiful, clear and blue, and you can see right down. It's clear and blue because there's nothing living there. If you go to polar waters, they look like soup. They're so thick, and you can't see through them at all because they're full of life. So if we could mix in the cooler waters from below, which contain loads of nutrients, with the hot water above, then the algae would grow again, start blooming. They would then pump down the carbon dioxide, make the cloud gas, and help cool the planet. How do we do it? It mightn't be that difficult. With enough pipes, just plastic pipes going down 100 meters, and using the wave energy, the waves as they come over, with a flat valve at the bottom of the pipes, water would keep coming up continuously, and perhaps it might do it.
We'll be back in just 1 minute after this break for station identification and a little music from the new album War Stories by Uncle. And I'm guessing from the title of the album they're talking about President George Bush and the great establishment of the world that keeps these war stories coming.
Just follow me.
are listening to an exclusive interview with Russell George, the CEO of the controversial carbon offset company, Planktos. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Okay, well now, there are 2 points here I'd like to discuss. First, both you and Lovelock say that the oceans are in big trouble and that the lovely blue water we see in most of the tropical oceans, as we've just discussed, indicate they're almost lifeless, perhaps dying. But Lovelock attributes this plankton loss not really to micronutrient lack, but a lack of mixing in the water due to warming of the seas under climate change. What makes you think that micronutrients will help solve the problem?
Well, we simply know from the hard data from the Earth science agencies like the NASA and NOAA and other agencies that we see a direct correlation of the decline in circulating atmospheric dust and ocean productivity. So at the same time as we've seen the Atlantic Ocean lose 17% of its plant life, we've seen a decline in the amount of dust that reaches the Atlantic Ocean, the North Atlantic Ocean, and that dust is not reaching those ocean regions because carbon dioxide in the air feeds terrestrial plants very well. And in the case of this planet, which is mostly covered with grass, not trees, where when the grass is green and lush, we call that good ground cover. And when it dries up in the summer and becomes brown and crispy, it's not very good ground cover. And the dust rises in the wind, and that dust doesn't go to waste. It actually feeds and nourishes our ocean. But with 44% more carbon dioxide in the world's atmosphere today than there was 100 years ago, CO2 is feeding grasses of the planet, where they get their CO2 out of the atmosphere at the expense of giving up water. And we know that grassland regions of the planet are staying greener for a few weeks longer each year in the summer, and that's a big part of summer. It's a big part of the dusty season, and directly correlated with that greening of the grass of the planet is a decline of the greenness of the ocean. And it's a classical ecological cycle here. You know, we live on spaceship Earth, and nothing leaves here, you know, and nothing goes to waste.
This is fascinating stuff. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. Our guest today is Russell George, the CEO of a pioneering company called Planktos. Their business is removing dangerous carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Well, Russ, Planktos has purchased a ship for this project, the 115-foot-long research vessel Weatherbird 2. Where is the ship now, and how has this project progressed?
Well, Weatherbird is sitting in a berth dockside in South Florida, awaiting the arrival of some mission-critical scientific gear. Ocean science isn't such a big field that there's lots of suppliers of different equipment, so when we ordered a lot of the equipment that was needed on the vessel for her mission, we thought it would arrive in May, according to our contracts, but just started to arrive in the past couple of weeks, so things have been a little bit slow. That's nothing new in the world of sort of frontier research, which is what this kind of ocean research is. So we expect that the ship will be underway sometime next month. In fact, just yesterday I hired our new captain, which was formerly one of the most senior captains of Greenpeace, who has decided that he'd like to join our project because he's passionate about saving the ocean, and he knows that we're working on that and is committed to help us. And when the ship leaves Florida, she'll head through the Panama Canal and into the eastern Pacific, and her destination is the eastern tropical Pacific near the Galapagos Islands, but still far west and well clear of the islands. And the reason why we go to that region is that the Galapagos Islands are a massive source of natural iron. The islands are, one, they're far out to sea. They're 600 miles out to sea. And two, the ocean there is very high in nutrients, but very poor in plant life. And that's because there are missing micronutrients. And the islands themselves contribute vast amounts of natural iron to the ocean there. And surrounding the Galapagos Islands is a massive plankton bloom that is produced by that natural iron. And that bloom enshrouds the Galapagos Islands and drifts 1,000 miles to the west. And it's the perfect biological control on the planet, natural control, for studying these iron-stimulated plankton blooms, which is what we aim to produce. And two previous major international science projects took place in the same area. So on one side of our Bloom project, we'll have that incredibly sterile, lifeless, ultra-clear water of the Pacific that was reported clearest water on Earth. On the other side of our project, we'll have the fabulously wonderful, rich environment of the Galapagos Bloom that makes those islands the marine oasis that they are. And our little bloom, that's a fraction of the size of the Galapagos bloom, will be squarely in between, and we'll be able to do the best possible science to determine whether this method really is a solution to restoring the world's oceans and replenishing life in those oceans and fighting climate change at the same time.
You know, you've taken some flack from environment groups who worry an untrained entrepreneur is going to single-handedly dump material into the ocean. It's a long lineup of people opposing your project. The World Wildlife Fund has spoken against it. Greenpeace has murmured about it, and others. And I notice you've answered your critics in the Ottawa Citizen and on your own website. First of all, to save us some time, can you give us the website so people can see your responses in detail?
Sure, you just go to planktos.com. That's like the word plankton, but with an S instead of an N. And there's an extensive website there that you'll see. And in the coming months, you're going to see a live internet educational site located there as well, where people in schools from around the world will be able to log on and watch the work of our international science team. Hardly our inexperienced, purely money-oriented entrepreneurs that some of our critics would like to say we are, doing the best science that has ever been done on ocean plankton. You know, no science expedition in the history of ocean plankton studies has ever had a ship dedicated to study a plankton bloom for its entire life cycle of the bloom. So the little weatherbird, she's a small but stout ship, will be on station all of the life cycle of those plankton blooms that we create, and also simultaneously studying the native bloom, the natural Galapagos bloom, at the same time. So we think that you know, we're doing the best science that has ever been conceived of in the ocean science world, and our critics have frankly we're just flabbergasted as to how they could spin their tails that a plankton bloom hundreds of miles west, downstream, downwind of the Galapagos, would defy the laws of physics and end up drifting back on the Galapagos and impact it where the Galapagos Islands themselves are enshrouded in a vastly larger plankton bloom of the same character. And everything we know about that Galapagos bloom is that it's a wonderful, life-giving, beneficial environmental feature on the planet.
Well, the government of Ecuador...
So the critics are... You know, they have their own motives for running their email campaigns that tell you to oppose Planktos and click here and make a donation. And some of the Greenpeace people who have objected to us from their armchairs are not in agreement with the Greenpeace mariners, you know, the frontline Greenpeace people from the ships who are joining us. So, you know, but everybody can stand by and watch, and we're going to do our job. And we're going to find out if this works. And if it does, it's a terrific possible potential solution for a planetary emergency.
Does the government of Ecuador, who are officially responsible for the Galapagos Islands, are they for your project or with it? Or how?
Well, we've had mixed comments from some of the government officials there. We're not going to be in Ecuadorial waters, national waters. We'll be far away from there in international waters. We simply have chosen that location because we like to use the Galapagos bloom as a research reference bloom. And we're hoping to periodically make, you know, port calls back to the Galapagos to refuel and restock the ship and to bring science and media crews on board. We've had requests from television stations around the world to come on board with us. So we hardly are operating in secret. We're inviting all comers to come and witness this and bear witness to the work and make sure, look over our shoulders, make sure we're doing the right thing. We're convinced we are.
Uh-huh. And then finally, the Scientific Committee of the London Convention, which is an agreement to control ocean dumping, issued a tough consensus statement of concern in Spain on June 22nd, a warning about environmental risks and lack of scientific evidence the process will work. Some call it even geoengineering. So how do you respond to that?
Well, the geoengineering that's taking place on this planet is the is the poisoning of the oceans with the anthropogenic CO2 that we're pouring into the oceans that have resulted in making the oceans 10% more acidic in the last couple of decades. And the Royal Society came out with a report a year and a half ago saying that ocean acidification was proceeding at such a rate that it was endangering all ocean life. You know, ocean plants often form little microscopic shells around them, like diatoms and things like that. And if you want to win the Nobel Prize in ocean science, you seek to win the Bigelow Medal. And Henry Bigelow once stole Walt Whitman's quote that said, "All beef is grass," and he commented that all fish are diatoms. Diatoms being one of the ocean plants, phytoplankton plants, and the Royal Society says the diatoms are dissolving, and they may go extinct by the end of this century. So that's a cataclysmic collapse of the ocean ecosystem. And so the people who suggest that working towards reversing that are doing some kind of geoengineering. Well, we might be doing geoengineering, but it's reverse geoengineering. We're the cure, not the cause, of the crisis in the ocean.
I hear you. Well, you plan to use nanotechnology for the iron dust. That's another wonder that I have. Do we know the environmental impact of putting ultrafine, rather unnatural particles into the sea?
Well, that's a misnomer. You know that one rather extreme environmental group has a problem with nanotechnology, who's completely distorted the view. What we're using is submicron iron rock dust, right? Anything under 1 micron in diameter is some number of nanometers in diameter. So our particles are typically 500 nanometers. The people who are expressed concern about nanoparticles are typically talking about dry systems. You know, when a nanoparticle is in the air and floating around, we talk about it as being a problem. As soon as a nanoparticle enters any liquid, a particle down around 200 nanometers, any particle in liquid, is called a colloidal particle. So your body, my body, every liquid on Earth is full of colloidal scale particles, which are in fact nano-dimensional particles. So our 500 nanometer particles are erroneously described as dangerous nanotechnology. That's simply erroneous, and knowingly so by the groups that have suggested that's a problem. And so it's just, you know, how else can we answer that except to say that they simply don't understand their chemistry or physics.
Well, I suppose anybody who sets out to do something cutting edge or new is going to get some rocks thrown at them from the establishment, if you like.
We're heading for the conclusion of our interview with Russell George, CEO of Planktos Corporation. Stay tuned next week for part two of our investigation of this radical experiment to capture CO2 right here on Radio EcoShock.
I wanted to ask you, you know, people can go to your website and they can buy a carbon offset for a trip that they might want to make. And, of course, they're going to want to know that the company that they deal with is reputable. Who does own Planktos?
Well, Planktos is a public company, so it's on the stock exchange. The trading symbol is PLKT. So, you know, people are buying and trading and selling the shares of Planktos every day. A good chunk of our investment funds have come from a few different green-minded investors. You know, one particular guy out of Vancouver who started, but most of the money is now originates in out of Zurich in London, out of the EU, where the marketplace for and the consciousness for climate change mitigation solutions is enormous.
Right. So one of your founding investors, I guess, was Nelson Scalbania.
I found him
on your website. Does he still have a controlling interest in the company?
No, he doesn't have a controlling interest. Another company called Solar Energy that he has shares in, that I own shares in, has a controlling interest in Planktos. But the control of the company is, you know, typical of public companies. It's a little bit obscure from the different shareholders and agreements that are in place to fund it. Any startup company has that situation. Nelson, I refer to Nelson to people who ask me what his position is, and I say he's my green angel. You know, he's a guy who came to me when he saw the project as a result of some work, other work we were doing, and he took one look at it. He's a very smart guy, and he said, "Wow, how often can you find a project that where you can save the world and make a little money on the side?" And he immediately wrote a check and said, "Let's get to work."
Well, in an April 2006 SEC filing, there was some doubt about the future of the company at that time. It was basically saying, should the funding fail to materialize in the next 12 months, the company will have to abandon the research and may be forced to cease its activities. Have things improved since then?
You know, startup companies are always, you're always one SEC filing behind in terms of your reporting to the public. So, and you're always, I'm an environmental guy, and I thought I would... I'd get to run this dream project of mine. I'd get a research ship. We'd get to go out to sea, and I've turned out to have to spend much of my time on the business side of it and investment money raising side. And it goes up and down, but we're still alive and running, and we have lots of funds that are committed and coming towards us. So we don't think that we're going to shut down anytime in the near future. But it's startup companies, you know, especially in very frontier areas like this. You know, always look a little bit risky. You know, so if you're looking for a bricks and mortar sort of no risk investment opportunity, don't buy PLKT shares. But if you're looking for a great possibility to save the planet and make a little money on the side, then we think we're the ticket.
Well, you know, there's one thing I'm hoping you might change about your presentations, if you don't mind my saying. And
sure.
I think that even though you may well be on the right track, isn't it important to make clear to people that are buying these offsets that they're buying future CO2 reductions, providing the company plans work out? Because so far the trees haven't been planted and the algae haven't been fed. And I don't feel that's really clear on the site.
I thought that was somewhat clear, but in fact, you know, carbon credits are sold by a vintage year. So in 2007, which is when we're selling credits, you know, we will surely have trees planted in our Hungarian forest projects, and we will most surely have our ocean plankton blooms underway and be booking onto our books, very large numbers of tons of carbon offsets. So we're very confident that we have our sales backstopped from our website. And frankly, we don't advertise the website very much. I'm happy that you're helping us out with some plugs here today, but there's not a lot of sales into that public voluntary market. Our primary focus is in the EU heavily regulated market. But we're certain we have all of the sales that we've taken covered.
All right. Well, we know that capturing carbon dioxide is really somewhat of a short-term solution, a fix to keep the climate alive while we go about the business of ending fossil fuel use. And you have another passion, maybe the real long-term solution, and that's in fusion energy. We can't spend a lot of time on that today. It's not really why I called you, and it's a complex science. But can you tell us a little bit about your work with fusion energy and your other company, D2 Fusion?
Well, in a nutshell, D2 Fusion is a company that's based here in the Silicon Valley. We have a laboratory engineering facility in Los Alamos, New Mexico, and we're engaged in that topic that 18 or almost 19 years ago was called cold fusion, with a couple of scientists, Fleischmann and Pons, made this momentous announcement to the world that you could fuse hydrogen atoms together and make helium, just in the same process where that powers the sun and the stars, but that in solid state environments, through a quantum physics mechanism, you could obtain this fusion with no radiation. And of course, nuclear power has always been the dream of lots of people. There it was, power too cheap to meter. But of course, it turned out to have that downside of nasty radioactive waste. That was a long-term issue and a critical issue for the health of the environment. But cold fusion, solid-state fusion, simply fuses two heavy hydrogens together and makes a helium atom in the absence, and makes a lot of energy in the absence of nuclear waste of any kind. So it's the And there's the scientific community around the world, while much of it still eschews it, we were heartened when the U.S. Department of Energy came out with a report a couple of years ago about cold fusion, and they said, well, there might be something there. It was worthy of research, and a team of nuclear scientists from Los Alamos said, we'd like to join your company. We've seen what they've reviewed. We think you're on a track. And so we're right about ready to make some pretty momentous announcements and demonstrations of cold fusion as a practical energy source.
Has your new tech been verified by independent labs or scientists?
Yes, it has. we have demonstrated it for the Electric Power Research Institute here in the United States. We've operated it at a number of national laboratories here in the U.S. and abroad. We have a team of scientists headed by Nobel Prize-winning physicists who are watching over our shoulder. And when we finally have everything ready, which is in the very near future, we're intending to sort of show you what the other side of the coin on the solution for global warming is, which is, we have to have a new energy source. We're going to run out of fossil fuel, and if we burn all the fossil fuel we have, we're going to kill the planet with the carbon dioxide it puts out. So we darn well better have some alternative energy. And fusion has always been that alternative that the world has been looking to. The problem has simply been it's so radioactive, it's hard to work with. Well, cold fusion has all the energy and none of the radiation.
Well, let's get back to the real reason for our call today about Planktos. And I want to ask you, what is coming up for you this year? How do you expect to see this whole venture unfold?
Well, a month's time, we hope to have the ship. We hope the ship will be in the Eastern Pacific, and around the early October, we think the first tree. We're confident that the first trees will be getting planted in the ground in Hungary. So we'll have our European Climate Forest Project will be underway, and we will have our ocean eco restoration project underway in the Pacific. And we'll be putting tons of carbon dioxide onto our books that hopefully we'll be able to sell in the marketplace. And we're quite certain because we have an incredible amount of interest already from major buyers around the world. And the business will be launched. And we really will be one of the green pioneers in providing real-time solutions for climate change.
We're talking with Russell George, the CEO of Planktos Corporation. Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners? And if so, go ahead and tell us now.
Well, I hope everybody understands that it also just takes everybody's small individual action to solve the problem of the fossil fuel age. If a typical family of four here in North America living in a single family home has a carbon footprint, that means they emit about 20 tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere each year. Well, if you go to our website or any of the many other websites that are selling carbon credits from forest projects and the like around the world, you'll find you can buy those carbon credits for $5 a ton, something of that nature. So 20 tons times $5 is $100 a year. Do that on a monthly basis, it's $8.33. So what family of four can't afford to take Mother Nature, out for a couple of cups of coffee, once a month, $8 a month, in order to take their carbon footprint and turn it from black to green by restoring the planet's ecosystems? I just don't know what's any simpler than that. And you can do that. And if you really want to know, how your impact on the planet can be measured in terms of carbon, I was in the London Underground the other day. I saw a terrific advert on the wall. It showed an empty plastic water bottle, and it pointed out that if you recycle your empty plastic water bottle instead of throwing it away, it saves enough energy that the carbon dioxide from that energy use, the saving of the energy, is equal to burning a light bulb for 5 hours in the evening. So you can sit down and you can read a book in the evening and put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and harm the atmosphere. Or if you recycle your plastic water bottle, you can be carbon neutral for that one evening's book reading time. And that's the kind of action everybody has to become aware of and realize that a billion small green steps will take care of the problem.
But meanwhile, you are working on large-scale solutions of replanting forests and possibly replanting the ocean forests.
Yeah, the large solutions are necessary, and a lot of people aren't going to be able to do everything that's needed on their own. You know, we're not like in China. I was in China recently, and I discovered that, you know, by law in China, every Chinese citizen has to plant 5 trees a year. So every year in China, 5 billion trees go into the ground. It's astonishing, right?
Right.
You know, that's it's a small green step, but it has a mighty effect on the planet. And those people who can't afford to go out and plant their own trees, they hire somebody to go and plant their trees for us. And that's what we do. You know, you can. We're an employment agency for green plants on the land and the sea. Right.
We've been talking with Russell George, the CEO of Plankto's Corporation. Thanks a lot for taking the time to talk with Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me on. I look forward to listening to it.
That was our exclusive show-long interview with Russell George, the CEO of the private carbon offset company that is breaking world news. We didn't have time to run clips from George's passionate speech at the Chicago Green Festival last spring, so we will do that next week. Now, the Pope endorses the Plankto's tree planting schemes, but mainstream environment groups hate the ocean seeding project. They worry about geoengineering, the lack of proof the carbon offsets will work. Greenpeace and others want us to all cut back on carbon rather than counting on algae to save us. We'll hear from the environmentalists and scientists next week. But can Plankto's even survive as a company? Can Nelson Scalbania, the green angel of the piece, keep finding new investors? Should we trust Russell George or Scalbania? Next week, we interview David Baines, the stock columnist for the Vancouver Sun, plus Pat Mooney of the environment group ETC. We'll dig into the science of ocean life depletion. And Russell George is right about that. Ocean life appears to be dying off at an appalling rate. Learn about all that, plus a surprise special guest. Plankto's Raising the Dead Seas Part 2 next week on Radio EcoShock. Find us on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver and on your local college and community radio station. We welcome a new station this week, CFMU McMaster University in Canada. Welcome aboard. Of course, you can always download the program a couple of days after the broadcast at www.ecoshock.org/cfro.html. Just go to our website at ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. This is Alex Smith. And thanks for taking this time to care about your planet.
I stand inside today at the edge of the future, and my dreams all fade away. I have burned my tomorrows, and I stand inside today at the edge of the future, and my dreams all fade away.